everyone, and welcome to another episode of Upzone, where every week we take just one big story from the news that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Kia, and I am back this week with my friend Chuck. How are you doing, Chuck?
Hey, doing great. It's kind of stormy here in Minnesota, but I'm actually headed to Florida tomorrow, and California the day after that. So I'm going to be all over the country in the next couple of days.
Are you doing both Disneys in this trip or just one?
No. I'm actually going to be in Pensacola, our strongest town in America, on Thursday. So the day before this comes out. And then on Friday, I will be in Santa Ana, California. And then, yeah, Saturday, I will be in Anaheim on Saturday. So.
I knew it. There's no way you would go to both of those places and not at least say hi to Mickey. Okay, well, I am ready to kick off this week. We have kind of a doozy of an article to talk about, in my opinion. We don't talk very much about the presidential race here at Strong Towns for some obvious and some not so obvious reasons. The obvious one being we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We will never and have never endorsed a presidential candidate. We're not doing that today. But every once in a while, a policy will sort of float past our desks that will get our attention and will really intrigue us. That policy today is called the American Mall Act by candidate Andrew Yang. He is a Democratic presidential hopeful, and he is proposing to spend $6 billion to resuscitate dying malls across the United States of America. Exactly how many malls is a little sketchy, but the number $6 billion is very prominent on his website. And the way he wants to do it specifically is by repurposing those malls to a more financially productive, I imagine, and certainly less auto-centric use. So this caught my attention because it came up on an article on CityLab, and it seemed like the tone of that article was like, let's do this thing. And I immediately said, I think Chuck's going to hate this, but I wanted to hear what you had to say. What do you think of candidate Yang's proposal here?
Well, I think you make a good point that this isn't about like partisan politics. I have really tried very intentionally to not listen to any, as little as possible of politics, you know, the presidential race at this point, because I'm not going to be a primary voter. I really don't want to be involved in it. Like I don't want the horse race is what I don't want. So when you sent me this article, I'm like, I don't want to talk about this. And then I read it and I'm like, you've got to be joking me. $6 billion to basically save, and I think they even use the word save or restore, 300 malls. It's important to realize that's $20 million a mall. I know my own local mall here, which would be one of those 300 that are likely to close in the coming decade, is appraised or assessed at $6.5 million. So the idea of spending, you know, $20 million or even $1 million or $2 million to resuscitate this thing is bizarre. In just fundamental economic terms, like it doesn't make any sense at all. I watched the announcement because there was a video that came along with this. Again, I don't want to get partisan about this. I don't know anything about Andrew Yang, and I apologize to people who are really passionate about him as a candidate. Maybe he's a great guy. Maybe he's not. He seems to be a Gen Xer, which I am. He talks about growing up with the malls being an important part of the community and having this feeling of sadness or loss because the malls are not what they used to be, and these huge places of asphalt that now are these wastelands. And he basically makes what is, in a sense, like an emotional case, like, oh my gosh, this used to be great and now it's not. America's a great country. Let's go back in and fix this stuff. And I'm like, that's a feeling that we're going to have to get used to in a way, or we're going to have to figure out how to respond to it in not crazy ways. Jim Kunstler calls it the psychology of previous investment. And that's a long way, I think, of saying something very simple, which is like, once we conquer a mountain, or once we, you know, put a stake in the ground, or once we build something, we have this assumption that it was right and it was good and it should be there and we should maintain it and we should fix it forevermore, like world without end. And when you look at the crazy stuff we've done over the last 70 years, the insane stuff we've built, the stuff that makes no sense at all, the idea that all of it must be saved and resurrected and put to good use, it's a nonsensical kind of idea. And one only needs to travel through, you know, your home state of Ohio to see, you know, the insanity of this. I mean, if you went in and said in Akron, Ohio, we're going to take care of every mall that's died, every street that's fallen apart, every amphitheater or public investment or park, or all this stuff has to be maintained as like a base level of us feeling good about ourselves. That's crazy. Like it physically can never happen. And doing so would be hugely destructive. If we've got $6 billion sitting around, why would we waste it on 300 malls?
I'm not sure from the proposal whether that $6 billion will go towards the 300 malls that are projected to fail in the next 4 years, or whether it would also cover, you know, you're referencing the Rolling Acres Mall in Akron, which closed a long time ago, and it's just sitting there like a sinkhole in the middle of this community. Now, like, the math aside, I get a little bit of a case of big scary numbers itis when I hear numbers like 6 billion, because I, unlike you, Chuck, do not know how much a mall appraises for in my community. I'm an average person. And I think like a lot of Americans, when I hear like giant number figures, I don't always have the first instinct to do the math. I try to make that my second instinct, but it's not natural tendencies for me. What I think is interesting about Yang's proposal, though, is that he's not saying, let's turn these malls back into malls. He's saying, how about we turn these malls into housing? How about we rezone these areas? How about we incentivize developers to turn these parking lots or gray fields, as CNU kind of coined the term, into something that's going to be a little bit more financially productive, a little bit of a better use of space? Does that seem like a better proposal than just make malls again? Or does it seem like just kind of another top-down intervention? Like, what should we do with these spaces that have already closed, if not turn them into something a little bit better?
So let's split this up into two different areas, right? I think two different types of geographies. And this gets a little bit into Daniel's, you know, trickle and fire hose analogy with housing. When you have the fire hose neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that are having all kinds of growth, all kinds of development, all kinds of investment capital today, the idea of going in and repurposing those malls into something else, it's hard to argue with that, right? If you are on the outskirts of New York City, if you're in Hoboken, if you are in Tyson's Corner by Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, yeah, you have a lot of energy going on in your market right now. You have a fire hose of, you know, pouring capital into your place. And the idea that this dead or dying or obsolete mall would just sit there like that is kind of silly. But it's also kind of silly from a market standpoint too. Like, we don't need $6 billion to bring back the mall in Tyson's Corner. We just need to kind of get out of the way and maybe fix our zoning code and not be so dumb about what we're requiring out there. If we go to Akron at the other end of the spectrum, where you've got not the fire hose of capital, but like the trickle of capital, the idea that we would spend money in a city like that, or a city like mine, out on the far outskirts of town, trying to resurrect this thing, largely because it hurts our feelings to see it fail, when there is so much need, so much pain happening in the core downtown and the core neighborhoods, where a tiny little bit of investment would go a long ways and would actually pay off for itself, would actually have like a financial return, and where you have would create energy that would essentially feed back and build on itself, as opposed to an isolated site out on the edge. This concept of saving the mall on the edge is really a kind of trip down nostalgia lane. And like I said, kind of this thing to make us deal with the grief of the fact that we made bad investments decades ago, as opposed to anything that makes sense from like a financial public policy standpoint. And that's where I struggle, because I look at the fire hose cities and I'm like, A, they don't need it. And B, if they did need it, like, there's all kinds of other ways to do this besides just spending money from the federal government on it, for sure. If you go to these trickle cities and you say, these are the places that are starved of capital and have all kinds of struggles, the mall becomes like this big vanity project that really doesn't get at where people are struggling and the types of investments that would actually improve people's lives. And just as a big general statement, and this does not go to, you know, Andrew Yang, this really goes to, you know, both political parties and really our centralized system of decision making. The things that need to happen in these cities are hyper local. They're very small and nuanced. One of the reasons I've opted out of following the political horse race is that I find it completely irrelevant to the things that we need to do in our core cities and our core neighborhoods to make them a lot better places. And this is kind of like prototypical of that kind of disconnect, I think, from reality.
It's such a challenging conversation, though, for the reasons that you point out. I mean, I remember when you wrote about Rolling Acres a long time ago, the Rolling Acres Mall in Akron, Chuck, you talked about it like, yeah, it makes sense if you're in a town which has only a trickle of development and you've seen this giant anchor that you invested a ton of money and time and just community energy into fail. It becomes kind of like a monument to your failure. And like, of course you want to see it brought back to life. You don't want to just like knock that thing down or let it sit on the edge of town and rot. Like, but it's completely subtracting from the energy that you should be putting into those smaller projects in your core downtown that are not going to bring you the same amount of glory as, you know, getting a grant from the federal government to reopen the Sears as a co-housing project or something like that, because that's symbolically is very exciting, but it is probably what's going to make your city stronger. It's this challenging question of like how, especially in an election year when we're all kind of have our eyes trained, whether we like it or not, by the news on federal candidates trying to apply federal solutions to local problems, which it has to be said again and again and again, like that is almost an oxymoron in a lot of cases, certainly not all. How do we get past that emotional hurdle of you're telling me that you want that mall to sit on the edge of my town and rot, and I don't deserve a better mall because I happen to be in a poor city? That's an emotional conundrum that I don't really know how to get past.
I don't know what I would have said about this problem 5 or 10 years ago. I do think that the social justice conversation we've been having in this country has actually helped me to see this in a little bit different way. I don't think I'm going out on a limb here to say that the more affluent you are, the larger tendency you have to vote. I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say that the more affluent and connected you are, the more kind of automatically listened to you are by the processes we've set up to make public policy decisions. You know, one of the, I'm reading a book right now. I can't even remember the name of it. I'll get it for the down zone. You know, one of the cases they make is that our obsession with funding education and especially college education really comes from the fact that a lot of people making public policy decisions and a lot of people influencing those decisions look at like the things in their life that have made them successful and they point to education. And that's not the case for a lot of very poor people. It's also not the case that a lot of very poor people can just follow in those tracks. Here's the point I'm getting at. If you are a more affluent person in, let's just stay with Akron as a vibe here. If you're a more affluent person in the Akron region, you're likely A, living on the outskirts more than you are in the center. B, driving more places than you otherwise would be. C, you're not taking transit. And so you are far more likely to, as part of your like day-to-day routine, drive by the Akron Hills Mall, you know, fallen, caved in, walls falling down, trees growing up in the middle, than you are to interact with one of the core neighborhoods or the core downtown. That mall is like a daily reminder of how sad and pathetic your community is, how you have failed. I think you can ignore the same kind of warning signals that have been going on for decades in other parts of the community because you just don't experience them. You don't experience them on a day-to-day basis. This is why I think it's so important for public policy officials to actually step back and say, okay, let me try to experience the world as people in my community do. Let me not react to this from the backseat of a car and react emotionally and put it through my own filter and lens, but let me actually go out and walk with the people in my community, particularly the people who are struggling and experience things in their light and through their eyes. And when you do that, the idea of prioritizing a mall becomes silly, bordering on offensive. It really does, because it is by no way the greatest priority of anyone who is truly struggling in the community. it is a sore spot for the people who, you know, like me, remember meeting their girlfriend, who's now my wife, at the mall and going to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure back in the, you know, the early 90s. That's my memories. Like, I remember that. Let's save that mall because, boy, it was such a great, important part of my youth. That's not a helpful public policy approach.
Let's just play Mad Libs for a second here, Chuck. If you had to, I know this is completely counter to your nature, but I'm kind of curious what you'll say. Forget the American Mall Act. Do the American Fill in the Blank Act. What would you like to see a candidate fund? And you can be a little sarcastic with this if that's your instinct. I want to give you that out.
Boy, that's really hard. You know, I wrote in my book just a little kind of end to one of the chapters where I said, you know, I have people ask me all the time, even people, you know, affiliated with the executive branch or legislative branch at the federal government, you know, what policy things should we be doing? What should we be funding? And I always get back to them with subsidiarity, like, you know, give more local control. If you said, Chuck, you've got $6 billion you got to spend, you got to come up with one flashy program you're going to do. I look at the people like the people at Small Change, who I've interviewed on the Strong Towns podcast, who are doing like local investment capital. I think that at the end of the day, what we need to do is localize capital more. And if you said you've got to spend $6 billion, I would spend it seeding like literally like local stuff, like the Historic Renaissance Group in Oswego, New York. People who are out like taking pennies and turning them into dollars by doing small little neighborhood things in communities. You do that, and there'll be, for every Oswego group who does great work, there'll be one from some place who does something really dumb and stupid and racist or prejudiced or whatever, and then they'll want to shut the whole program down. I think as a society, we should embrace like the Oswego and hold them up as the model, and then not do the program because you'll get the other one, right? I think we got to figure out how to work and push back on the other one, as opposed to like, nope, we got to do this all from the federal level. I would try to localize the spending priorities more. Instead of saying, we're going to fix the mall, say, here's the system that we're going to use to empower local decision-making. Instead of giving the city, we'll give you $10 million to build a wastewater treatment expansion, say, we'll give you $3 million to do whatever the heck you want, as long as you're doing it in small projects and addressing people's needs. That would be my tendency, even though I don't think that's necessarily a great program either.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of an organization that Jacob interviewed called the Awesome Foundation. So we'll call it the American Awesome Act. How about that?
I would support that. The American Awesome Act.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds awesome to me. All right.
Can I just say one last thing? I really want to say this again. I don't know anything about Andrew Yang, except that I see him every now and then.
It's the first time I've heard his name today. Honestly.
Okay. There's a lot of people in my Twitter feed and Facebook feed who really like him. I'm all for people coming up with new ideas. And I love the fact that he's actually like trying to connect some things at the ground level and say, you know, this is a pain point for local communities, because it really is. So I don't want to just like diss him this whole thing. I'm sure he's a good guy and I'm sure he's a smart man and trying to figure some things out. I just think, you know, read some Strong Towns, dude. We'll help you out a little bit here.
We'd love to talk to you. All right, let's go now to the down zone. Chuck, you mentioned a little earlier that you've been reading something interesting. I'm wondering if the title has come back to you, or if you've been watching something interesting, listening to something interesting, anything that's getting you through these summer months, we'd love to hear about it.
It's funny because I just finished watching this series, AMC series called The Terror, that Josh McCarty with Urban 3 recommended to me. It's about a ship, two ships that tried to find the Northwest Passage and got frozen in, and the experience they went through, and it was pretty intense. The book I'm reading right now is called The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boom Stole Millennials' Economic Future. It was recommended to me a couple times, and I'm like, you know, boomer bashing is like, I'm a Gen Xer, so it's like right in my wheelhouse. It's too easy to do, right? And I try to avoid books that are just pure confirmation bias. So I'm like, I'm not going to read that. And then I actually saw a review of it that said, this guy's really even-handed and is kind of hard on millennials and boomers equally and lays it out in a really good way. I'm six chapters in this book. It's a good book. I mean, I do feel like it is very insightful And also, without triggering, I think boomers, I think a boomer could read this and go, yeah, this is a fairly decent analysis. It gets into a lot of just the economic trade-offs. You don't let housing prices fall in 2008. And so you save the housing market for boomers, but you make it unaffordable for millennials. And I mean, I think that's like a pretty straightforward analysis. He does that over and over and over. It's really eye-opening. Very good book.
I'll have to check that out. You know, I had dinner the other day with my 25-year-old cousin who called me an elder millennial in conversation. So,
I'm sorry about that.
I need to get my elder millennial party line together and figure out how I feel about boomers. So I made fun of him. Shout out to Rich if you're listening. I'm going to submit something a little different for the Down Zone. Well, I'm going to give you two. One is a book I'm just like 20 minutes of audiobook away from finishing called The Underland by Robert McFarlane. He is best known as a nature writer and a nature documentarian. And he wrote this fantastic book about basically all the things that human beings do and impact underground, like everything from how when we drill for oil, what happens when we dig the catacombs under Paris, what happens? Our effect on like a deep glacial ice melt, our effect on the way trees communicate. It's really good. It's really lyrical. It's super long. And I just like listened to it awestruck all weekend. And I'm really looking forward to kind of hearing the last word because he's just a great writer. And then this isn't really a media hit list item, but we are throwing a party this weekend for our dog. We are doing a breed reveal party for our dog, Zozobra. We sent off his DNA to a 23andMe for pups kind of a place. And I got a friend to look at the results for us. We're printing them on a photo cake for the dog. And I've been reading up on all of the possibilities of what he could be. That's been consuming a lot of my stuff. So tune in next week to find out if my dog is, right now the options are like Australian Shepherd, Coyote, Dachshund. There's like a whole list of things that he might be, and we're all going to guess and then we're going to find out. So,
hey, Kia, no offense, but I think you just confirmed that you're 100% millennial.
No elder millennial here, smack in the middle. Okay, well, thank y'all for listening in to another episode of Upsound. If you want to support the show, you can always support the Strongtowns movement at strongtowns.org/membership, or give us a review on iTunes or whatever listening platform you are into. Thanks so much, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.